What I'll be talking about today is actually, isn't that too bad? Okay. About colloidal aggregates with oppositely charged bilayers. In a lot of ways, this study has been motivated by Cirrus's work, which is was an inspiration to a large group of us. And this is a collaboration between me and the minority, both as an engineer and from Delaware, and a group of people from physics at the University of Pennsylvania. Laurence Ramos is actually, as of last week, in Montpellier. She went back to France. She did experiments with Dave Waits. Tom Lubensky and Phil Nelson and I collaborated on the theory and understanding what's going on in the system. And the real question is, what happens when you take colloidal suspensions and mix them with oppositely charged surfactants? And the first thing that we generally know about any kind of screening effect in charged colloidal suspensions is that it leads to flocculation. And people have seen very beautiful fractal type aggregates. This is taken from Veronique Trapp's work at the University of Pennsylvania, where essentially we see here the colloidal particles. They're aggregated because the surfactant is screening the electrostatic interactions between them, and these bulk aggregates grow. They're also pretty fragile, so under shear or any change in conditions, they will break and reform. Another type of aggregate, which we've heard quite a lot about just now, is something that, for lack of a better word, I would call an ionic type crystal. One of those might be where we have charged particles mixed with oppositely charged micelles, and we'd expect this to form a large structure that reminds us of just a large ionic crystal similar to NaCl packing or something like that. Cirrus just showed us that these systems can form different types of geometries depending on your components, which is what's interesting in surfactants in general. They can have all these different phases, and so here this is supposed to be a cross-section of the DNA lamellar structure where you have the cylinders packed between flat bilayers. I didn't put a picture of the hexagonal type aggregate, but that's essentially a similar type thing. And the thing that characterizes these ionic type crystals is, first of all, they're kind of bulk structures. Their microstructure is defined by the system, but there's nothing that defines their size, their bulk. Our question was really to think what happens now if instead of taking the DNA, which is a fascinating molecule, but also hard for some people to work with, and just replaced it with charged colloidal particles. And so the system that Laurence and Dave have used, and I can't take claim for saying we because, of course, I've seen the inside of the lab maybe twice, they've mixed cationic surfactant, DDAB. It's a two-chain surfactant or lipid, depending on your definition, and it forms bilayers. Has a given surface area per molecule, a relatively low CMC, and this surfactant was mixed with non-ionic surfactant, commercially known as TX. Single-chain surfactant forms micelles. Has a similar surface area per molecule, similar CMC, and so essentially they both form phases at about the same overall surfactant concentration. And as we well know, if we start with the pure non-ionic surfactant forms micelles, we mix a little bit of DDAB, the cationic one, into it, we'll get mixed micelles. On the other side of the phase diagram, we'll have pure cationic bilayers, mix a little bit of the non-ionic ones, and we'll have mixed bilayers. And in between, there's different structures coexisting. And I have to admit that this phase diagram for this specific mixture is not, as far as I know, very well characterized. We took, or they took, the mixture of the two surfactants and now added negatively charged polystyrene latex particles. The diameter in general was about 1 micrometer, so these are huge particles. We're talking about much larger scales than anything we've heard about in the talk before. There were three types of particles used with different surface groups. All of them are negative. And the two system parameters that we can use for this three-component system is, one, the fraction of cationic surfactant in the mixture. The other one is the overall surfactant concentration. And the third one is the volume fraction of the spheres. And this parameter I won't even refer to because it's been kept at very low, up to about 1% of the overall volume. And so now the question is, what did we see in the experiment? And what we saw was something quite beautiful, and I apologize for the quality of the transparencies, but essentially 2 days after waiting for about 2 weeks, you see two-dimensional, hexagonally packed, oval-shaped or circular-shaped aggregates. These are two-dimensional in the fact that going into the screen, you have at most 5 to 10 layers of particles. In most cases, you have just one layer of particles. So this is like a sheet or a rigid aggregate of colloidal particles. And here are two different examples. There are some defects in there that that recur pretty regularly. But the fascinating part is that here we have a system that seems to have a well-defined size. This did not grow to infinity, has a well-defined geometry because it's two-dimensional. It's not growing in either dimension. And the question that we would like to understand is how these form and why. Bill.
What kind of experiment? What is
this? This is simple microscopy, light microscopy. The sort of
the colors are what size are the colors?
1 micron diameter. That's why.
No.
Well, right now they are. But when they form, and I'll show you in the film, they're free-floating in solution. So to preempt this, where this question is going, they do not seem to form at an interface, either at the air-liquid interface or at the glass slide interface. Bill.
And for a given set of conditions, do you always see the same size? Or do you?
Excellent question, but you'll have to wait. Okay. So to tell you in general what the results for these two-dimensional crystals are, we see that they have hexagonal close packing of the spheres, oval aggregate shape as a rule. When we do, or when they do, I shouldn't appropriate that, they do confocal microscopy at the later stages again for the crystal phase, and they see that the particles are completely coated by surfactant. And something that's really interesting is that these are extremely stable, and I think that also would probably relate to Cirrus's complexes, even though they're different. They resist shear. They're very strong, so that if you just mix the slide or the sample, they stay together. Also, they've tried to tweak some particles away from these aggregates using laser tweezers, and they couldn't. So that tells us that the interactions between the particles are relatively strong. It's insensitive to chemistry. As I mentioned before, there were three types of surface chemistry used for the particles. That doesn't seem to matter. Different non-ionic and cationic surfactants, changing the tail length and things like that. Adding co-surfactant, which, as we know, can change the bilayer properties very strongly, didn't seem to make a difference at all. The only thing is that prevents these from forming is if you add a lot of salt, which is sort of understandable. So, as I said, to get these crystals, it takes an order of magnitude of 2 weeks. And Cirrus calls 2 months preliminary results. Some of these results are from a few weeks ago, and so this is really preliminary. And we don't have any quantitative data regarding the kinetics of formation and things like that. So it's all order of magnitude. But if we look at the initial stages in these mixtures, we see different types of structures. And this is, in some ways, it's not a very well-defined system because you see these different structures coexisting all together. One type is floppy-type vesicles. Here you see a banana-shaped one. Here it's something that is less well-defined. Essentially, these are aggregates of particles that are adsorbed on a bilayer, and you see them coexisting with particles that are swimming in solution. Some of them seem to be dimerized, and maybe we don't know if that's just an accident or if they're really smaller aggregates as well.
Those are colloids absorbed on the vesicle?
Yeah. And again, in this film, you'll see much more clearly how they behave. But what's more interesting is that, I hope this shows, we see also tense vesicles that have rafts on them. Now, what do we see here? Here we see an oval-type aggregate of particles. Now, the particles, both in this case and in the previous slide that I've shown you, are free to move. You can see them diffusing very rapidly. They're not locked in. They're not frozen yet, as in the later stages crystals. So they are moving, but they seem to be confined to this circular area on top of the vesicle. And as you go through the focus to look at different depths, you see that this is actually a large vesicle, and here this naked region that you see is not just an accident. It's actually the vesicle cross-section, and you can see that there are no particles on it anywhere else. Okay? So this seems to indicate that you have two types of structures coexisting in these systems, one of tense vesicles that have this raft on it of loosely aggregated particles, and the other one is of flaccid or floppy vesicles that are completely covered.
Yes? This aggregate, is it no on the left? Is it absorbed on the surface of the vesicle? Is that
yeah.
What you're telling us?
Yeah, yeah. And again?
It has a two-dimensional surface.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But it's not the air or the glass slide.
Ah, it's a vesicle.
Yeah? It's an interface. I hope I didn't say that it doesn't. Okay. So I apologize for this. What? We'll have to talk about that. These ones, these are colloidal particles. What? This one? That's a particle. That's a colloidal particle, 1 micron in diameter.
And coated by surfactant?
We don't know in this case. I mean, we know that they are sitting on top or on the side or bottom, as the case may be, of a large vesicle. And you can see the vesicle membrane. We don't know, although you'll hear later what we think about that, whether they are actually covered in each individual particle is covered in surfactant or not. And we definitely don't know about these individual ones that are swimming around in solution. I would speculate that they are covered in some bilayer type structure, but I don't know. These are lying on the surface of the large vesicle. Yeah.
A tense vesicle is a sphere, a tense sphere.
Yeah. It's not flat. Yeah, yeah. Again, I hope we'll try and see the film, and then you can see how you focus through and you really see, you go through the cross-section, you see the raft, and then you see the rest of the vesicle that has no particles on it.
Go on.
Okay. No. No, but again, the procedure is as follows. They make the vesicle suspension of the surfactant separately, then the colloidal suspension separately, and then they mix them together. So we'd be very surprised if you'd see particles inside the vesicles. So, but my no is qualified because, again, it's very hard to see when you're looking. You don't always know what's inside and what's outside. Okay. I'll just flash a couple more pictures because I wasn't sure what would show well and what not. Again, we see tense spherical vesicle with this sort of raft on it, and it seems like these particles that seem to be lying on the surface are actually not connected to the surface. And here you can see a side view because this vesicle is rotating. I'm sorry, it's really dark, but this is the raft, this is the spherical tense vesicle, and in this case it rotated, so now the raft is on the side. And so these are freely moving in the solution. You can do some quantitative analysis as well. And for instance, look at the mean square displacement as a function of time to get an idea of how these particles move. Because as I said, in the raft, the particles are not frozen in a fixed position. They seem to be diffusing relatively rapidly. As we'd expect, those that are attached to the raft are moving more slowly than those that are free in solution.
You don't bother two-dimensional diffusion on the vesicle now?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So they're moving on the surface of the vesicle within this oval-type raft. And this is compared to the free particles in the solution that you can see next to them. And so I don't want to go into the numbers, and we're not quite sure what the slopes mean. There are various ideas, if it's just larger concentration, the fact that it's two-dimensional movement on a bilayer and all that. But essentially, we see they're free to move. It's not, their movement is not very hindered, the same type of time dependence and all that. Another thing that is very important is you can look at the structure factor, and this is a relatively large raft on a spherical vesicle. And what you can see is that obviously we have strong excluded volume interactions, but that there doesn't seem to be any long-range repulsion between these particles, and that on average they like to be within more or less two particle diameters of each other. So they're not closely packed, they're not very far from each other, and there doesn't seem to be a strong interaction that repels them from each other. What? The particles are 1 micron diameter. And you can do a very crude phase diagram, and this is crude because we have various points in these areas, but they're not in any way, shape, or form well characterized. If you have a very low concentration of surfactants, then you get fully dispersed particles, which is what we'd expect because it's below the CMC. So even if the particles are coated a little bit by whatever surfactant there is around in solution, it's not enough to really screen interactions. If you have only purely or non-ionic surfactant, then essentially you have very loose flocculates that are probably induced by exclusion type interactions. In the other limit where you have pure cationic bilayers, you also see different types of flocculates. And we see the crystallites or the rafts only in the middle where we have to have a mixture of ionic and non-ionic surfactant. And that is a key point because that indicates to us that it's not just electrostatics that are binding these particles and creating these rafts. There is something to do with the fact that you need a mixture to form them. Okay. So just to summarize the experimental observations, we see colloidal aggregates with cationic bilayers can form two-dimensional crystallites and rafts, which are the precursor for these crystallites. And to summarize the observations in a truth table, if we have a tense vesicle, it always has only partial area coverage, that is rafts. In principle, you never see the tense vesicles with complete coverage. It's in parentheses because it's qualified, and there are a couple of cases where it's not quite clear, but you always see partial area coverage, that is rafts on tense vesicles. You never see them on flaccid ones, and that's the key point. The flaccid vesicles always seem to be covered in particles. And in the case where we have the pure cationic bilayer, we never see rafts forming. Okay? So that is the key point. And now, if this works, I can try and show you some. It should be on. Okay. Okay. So what you see here is a crystallite, and so this is at later stages of formation after about a week or two. You see, you saw for a minute Laurent focusing just to show you how stable it is and that it is one particle thick.
Here,
right now it is real time. I mean, she's jumping between different cuts, but this is real time. Here you see it, the floppy vesicle. I showed you a slide of it before where it seems to be completely covered with particles. This is the banana-shaped one. Again, you see they're all moving very rapidly, both those that are in the on the vesicle and those that are outside. And she's focusing here to see that the whole thing is covered. This is another floppy type vesicle, and again, everything is moving, and there doesn't seem to be any defined shape.
Used by the adoption,
what?
The banana shape. It's like more surface.
Actually, these are non-equilibrium vesicles, so the way they're formed is the ratio of volume to surface is pure accident. And so that was probably one that just had a lot of surface area relative to the enclosed volume. Now, here you see the raft that I've shown you in the slide where the raft is on the side here, and I hope you can see this tense spherical vesicle away from it. And as she focuses, you see she loses the raft. So it is really on a particular finite area of the vesicle, and it seems like there's hardly any other particles absorbed on the rest of the vesicle. Here we have a top view of a raft. Everything disappeared because she's shearing the sample, and as you can see, the raft stays intact. Even though the particles in it, this is at slightly later stages, so the particles aren't moving as rapidly as in the beginning, but still, this shear is not enough to make it break. It was just enough to flop the vesicle, and now you see the side view where the raft is here and the vesicle is on top. Well, the particles are definitely hexagonally packed, at least at later stages when they stop moving. The whole raft, I don't know, it seems to be systematic, and you'd expect that if you have hexagonally packed particles that the overall shape would be more or less hexagonal as well. But like the first one that you saw for just a minute wasn't perfect. It had defects around it. Now, this is the later stages of the crystallite, and I'm not sure if this is confocal microscopy or not, but essentially she's refocusing and refocusing through the... Well, the confocal was to see if the particles are really covered throughout so that it's not just stayed absorbed on a bilayer, but that they are covered... The vesicle disappeared at this stage. This is just... This crystallite seems faceted, but there's no vesicle anymore. At the later stages, the vesicles disappear. So now we have free-floating crystallites with this shape that are just floating around in solution. They're not attached to anything. Well, we know that they're covered by a bilayer or by surfactants. That's the end. We know that they're covered by surfactant. They must be, and also from the using fluorescent lipids, we can see that these particles are all covered. But there's no large bilayer structure like we had in the vesicle case.
But then they become unstable. I mean, the structure becomes unstable.
What, the crystallites? It's incredibly stable. Okay. This is the crystallite. This is the crystallite at the later stage. No, this is two-dimensional.
Okay.
Let me just, for the crystallized structure, first clarify this. This is a two-dimensional structure. It's usually one layer. At most, we get it at 10, but it's no more than 10 layers thick.
But you talk about the 10 layers thick. I mean, what you just saw before was several layers.
Yeah, that one was up to 10, but never more than that. So it's not really a bulk structure.
No, but that's 10.
10 is low. I mean, how many layers would you get in one of your complexes in 2,000 angstroms?
Yeah. 10 is not considered two-dimensional. That's all I said. No.
Well, okay. It's a matter of definition. I mean, as I said, most of these are just one, at most two particles thick. And if you are bored and want to start counting how many particles you have here compared to having 10 thickness, you're still more or less in the region where it looks like a sheet of paper and not like even this box or something. So what we wanted to understand now is how these form, or at least what are the ideas that lead to this truth diagram. And especially we focused on the tense versus flaccid vesicles, where the tense do have the rafts on them, because obviously if you can't get the rafts, you're not going to get these crystallites, and the floppy, fully covered ones. And for that, we need to do a little bit of geometry, and you don't need the Phil Nelson to do that, but we have a vesicle that is non-equilibrium, and so the ratio between its surface area and its volume is essentially an accident of formation, or you have a whole range of these depending on how you make the suspension. And so we can use two parameters. One is A, the overall surface area of this system, and delta, which we call the excess area, that is how much area can you take away before the tension in the membrane becomes unsupportable. And unsupportable is a matter of definition, but before it increases to a high rate. We can also define the fraction of cationic surfactant in the mixture, and also talk about the area available for adhesion. And this is a topic that is a little vague. How can you define what is the area available for adhesion? One simplistic view would be just to say if we have an overall surface area A, we have C fraction of cationic surfactants, C times A would give us the area that the particles want to adsorb on, because they're positively charged, the particles are negatively charged, that's the area that the particles would like to take over. It's not as simple, but indeed in a classical paper from 1972, Persegian and Gingell have shown that optimal adhesion between two surfaces requires matching charge densities, which in our case would correspond to more or less a density of pure cationic lipids in the area where the particles absorb. Now, that means that if we have a mixture of non-ionic and cationic surfactants or lipids in the bilayer, you'd have recruitment of the charged component to the area where the particles adhere. And that is, of course, not unheard of. Becky Menes with Phil Pincus here did a very nice calculation where she's shown that if you have a fluid membrane with only a fraction of charge, where the charges are free to move, and in this case it was rods adsorbing on it, you will have recruitment of the particles to the area, and she's calculated exactly how much that recruitment would be. We have done some simulations where we see essentially the same thing. This is a depletion of the counterions above the rod. This is an enhancement of the surface charges near the rod, and There's some dependence on the surface charge density, but essentially the qualitative idea that you need recruitment of charges in the surface to where you have an oppositely charged object absorbing is very reasonable. There's also a very recent paper by Nardi et al. Where more or less the same idea. You have, in this case, two-component bilayer adhering to a surface, and you get these blisters where you have areas of perfect adhesion and a concentration of, in their case as well, the cationic component near the surface, and then areas where you have depleted concentration and, in this case, blisters. Also, we need to consider what happens when a particle absorbs on this soft surface. And because it's a soft surface, the particle can take up some area of adhesion. And so if we call R the particle radius, we can define the area of adhesion as simply the 2 pi R squared times phi, that is how much quantity that defines how much of the particle is actually coated by the bilayer. I'm sorry about my dimensions. Phi of 2 means complete coverage where the particle is completely engulfed. I should have divided it by 2, but oh well. We also have a definition of the excess area that this particle takes up when it absorbs, because if it gets engulfed by the bilayer, it's going to take up excess area of the membrane. And so we need to define that, and that is also something that is proportional to the particle surface area, pi r squared, and in this case, phi squared, this parameter. And phi is related just to the contact angle, if you'd like, or the degree of coverage of the particle by the bilayer. And so now when we look at the complex, we can define it as having n, some number of adsorbed balls with the vesicle. And we have two constraints now. One is that the number of particles times the area that they, of adhesion between them and the bilayer must be smaller or equal to the maximal amount of area available for adhesion. Okay, this A0, which I haven't defined for now, but qualitatively should be proportional to the vesicle area and the composition. The other one, which is also very important, is that the number of balls times the number times the amount of excess area that they take up must be smaller or equal to the amount of excess area. Because if the balls would want to take up more excess area, membrane tension would become so high that it would counter the adhesion and therefore either pop the ball out or at least partially pop it out so it won't take up that much excess area. Okay. And so I'm going to walk you through now some discussions that we've had, only I'll save you the swear words and so forth. I was the only one who swore, by the way. Tom and Phil never swear. Not this Phil, by the way. If we talk about simple adhesion, so we have some W energy per unit area of adhesion. The total energy that the complex would gain by particles adhering to the bilayer would be simply proportional to the adhesion energy, the number of particles, and the area per particle of adhesion. Obviously, you don't have to know a lot of math to know that in this case, we're our energy is linear with the number of particles, and the energy would essentially be minimized when the adhesion area is maximized. That is when we've used all this A0 area available for adhesion. That's sort of obvious. But what does that tell us as far as the complex is concerned? And that tells us then that the total area of adhesion would be given by A0, but what does it say about the excess area? So we just take our definition of N, the number of balls, which is simply A0, the area available for adhesion, divided by the area of adhesion per particle, and then you get this relationship for the condition on the excess area. So it tells us that speed, the degree of coverage per ball, is really not well defined. So all this idea of adhesion tells us is that you would want to maximize the area of adhesion, but it doesn't tell you how many particles would absorb and how much they'll be covered. So that these two cartoons are equivalent, one particle that is completely engulfed versus two particles that are only half engulfed. Okay? And all it does is give us a maximum on this degree of coverage. Now, if we try and get some conclusions from this, it tells us that it's, in principle, we shouldn't see either tense particles or partial coverage. We should take up all this A0 available for adhesion, but there's no reason to see tense vesicles because there's no reason to take up any significant amount of excess area. Also, a point that is very important is that there's nothing specific to mixtures here, and so therefore, this idea alone doesn't work. Okay, so back to the drawing board, and what do we do now? Well, we haven't defined really this area available for adhesion. I just now told you it's A0, but we don't know what it is. And so we start thinking again and said, well, you have this adhesion energy that wants to concentrate the cationic surfactants in the adhesion area, but that's countered by mixing entropy and possibly some other interactions, which we, for now, we didn't go into, especially because we have no idea what those might be. And therefore, you can write the energy now as an adhesion energy plus some term that has to do with mixing, which counteracts this tendency to separate. And so you can minimize this energy, and what you get is essentially what this fractional degree of vesicle area that wants to be covered by the particles is, and obviously it would increase as the adhesion energy what?
You have the label part.
Yeah, but it's the battery is going out, I think. Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to use that big one. Okay, so we have now a relationship for the concentration of surfactant outside the adhesion area and the fraction of the area that is essentially available for adhesion. And as we'd expect, this fraction would become larger as the adhesion energy per unit area becomes stronger. And what this does is it gives us an estimate for what the area available for adhesion is as a function of the initial mixture composition, but it doesn't tell us anything that we didn't know from before, which is it doesn't tell us why do we see tense vesicles, because there's nothing here that tells us, that gives us an indication what the degree of coverage per particle should be or what the amount of excess area taken up would be. And so this one also doesn't work. Don't worry, this is the last one. So, okay, but we're making progress, because now if there is demixing, which we said the particles would induce, then there's a penalty that you always pay for demixing, which is something that in this two-dimensional case would be a line tension. In three-dimensional cases, it's a surface tension, and essentially that's what brings in phase-separating systems why you get bulk phase separation. The isolated demixed areas essentially aggregate to reduce this penalty. And so now we can define two other parameters. One is the circumference of this adhesion area that would give us the length of the line over which this line tension is felt, and also dimensional line dimensionless line tension, capital gamma, which tells us what is this demixing penalty. And this number, I should tell you, is extremely small. You can estimate it. Lipovsky has a paper where they've calculated it and compared it to some experiments. It's very small compared to the adhesion energy. But we can still put it in. We get this relationship for the free energy. Now we see we have a parameter here that could be either positive or negative depending on the value of this phi. If this parameter here is positive, then we won't get any adhesion. The number of particles absorbing on the surface would be zero. But of course that doesn't happen because the system can always make this in some combination to be positive, in which case you'd want the number of particles absorbing to be maximal. So that tells us that, again, our condition for the maximal number of particles absorbing on the surface is given by the saturation of the overall area available for adhesion, which I've just calculated in model number 2. But now when I put it in, I have this line tension function which depends on the degree of coverage. And so that breaks down the degeneracy that we had before and gives us a preference for a certain degree of coverage for the system. And what it tells us essentially is that the system, everything else being equal, would like to have the particles completely engulfed. Why? Because in that case, it's the same as in the case of zero engulfment, the line tension is minimized. But if you have complete engulfment, you also have adhesion energy, and so that's the preference, the preferred state. However, what's important to notice is that this is monotonically decreasing. And so now if our excess area constraint tells us that we can't go to complete engulfment, we'd still want to have the maximum degree of coverage per particle, which tells us that we have a specific degree of coverage per ball, which tells us that we would want to consume all our amount of excess area if we run into this constraint. So this tells us that we want to create tense vesicles with a given degree of coverage. And so what this model tells us is that in principle the particles would always want to use all the area available for adhesion the way we've defined it. If the excess area is larger than the area available for adhesion, you'd get flaccid vesicles covered with this degree of A0 of particles. But if the excess area is smaller than the area of adhesion, you'd still use up all the area available for adhesion, but you'll get tense vesicles. Okay? So this simple idea of this line tension gives us now a distinction of why we can get either flaccid vesicles or tense vesicles depending essentially on the accident of their formation. Okay, so nobody jumped, but one of the questions that you would ask is why do we see that the flaccid vesicles are usually completely covered while the tense vesicles with the rafts are not? If we said that in both cases they want to maximize the area available for adhesion A0, the composition of the mixture is always the same. We're not taking into account that you can have different composition vesicles, and so you would expect in both cases to have the same degree of coverage. So again, if you just do a little bit of geometry, if you look at the flaccid vesicles, in that case we said they want to be completely engulfed, and if we wanted to know what the degree of coverage is, or what A0 is to get close packing, then you get that you need about 80%, okay? Because the ratio between this area gives you 80%. Now, if you do the same thing for tense vesicles, that is when our amount of excess area is limited, in this case I took the two to the excess area and the area available for adhesion to be equal, so all the particles want to be only half covered. What you get is that for 80% of the whole vesicle area available for adhesion, when you look at the tense vesicle, you would see only 40% of the vesicle covered. So again, this simple idea seems to be consistent with the fact that flaccid vesicles would be more or less completely covered and closely packed, while the tense vesicles would have a finite number of particles on them that are only partially covered.
You said things depend on composition of the vesicles.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that the main factor dictating how much absorption you get? Because you said about the recruitment.
Yeah, A0 depends on the initial composition of the mixture. And
okay, so it's already. Yes.
Yeah. And that's why I said the line tension is very small. So the line tension doesn't really change much how much area is available for adhesion. That's more the constraint of charge matching between the particles and the bilayer. And I hope, Bill, this answers your question from half an hour ago. No? So ask again. Okay. Okay. So to go back to our truth table, we said that we've seen rafts and crystallites that are observed in mixtures of colloidal particles with mixed oppositely charged bilayers. The observations indicated that you have rafts or partial coverage only on tense vesicles, hardly ever complete coverage on tense vesicles, although that's not out of the question. It should depend on the composition parameters. You never see rafts on a flaccid vesicle, and you always see them, or more or less always, see complete coverage of flaccid vesicles, and you always need a mixture to see these rafts form. And the simple model that we suggest here, where you have adhesion induced demixing that leads to a line tension, seems to at least qualitatively give us this these predictions. Now, before people jump in, there are two things that I haven't mentioned. And so one is, why are the rafts rafts? What I gave you now is an argument for why we would have a finite number of particles adsorbed on a tense vesicle. I didn't say anything about why those are locked into this oval area on the surface of the vesicle. Because in principle, there's no reason why we shouldn't see something like this versus seeing this kind of aggregate. Now, I wish I could tell you that it's the line tension, okay? Because if we have a line tension, then obviously these particles would want to be together and minimize also the overall area or the overall line here. That doesn't work because the length scale for the line tension or for demixing is a molecular length scale. The spacing between these particles is of order particle diameter, which is 1 micron. And there aren't that many molecules that are 1 micron large, at least not in our system. So that is not an explanation. And so something that we're trying to explore now is whether the idea suggested a while ago by Gulyan, Brunsma, and Pincus that such sites could be essentially pinning sites to a membrane that reduce the membrane fluctuations. Aggregation of these pinning sites would reduce the penalty for that and therefore would drive the particles together so that we'd have a larger area available for fluctuations. Now, the truth is I don't know if this would work because the interactions between the particles are relatively strong in the raft, and these are tense vesicles where the fluctuations are largely damped. So we're exploring this, and I can't say for now whether that's the answer or not. And if anybody has an idea for 1 micron range attractive interactions for particles like this, I'd be happy to hear that.
If an interaction of the order of the size of the particle, it doesn't have to be a long range. If the particle is a micron, so it can be a short range interaction of the size of the diameter.
That's a good idea. We're also thinking about that. I'm still not sure the van der Waals forces over a micron scale. I mean, it is the particle scale, but on that scale, you can think about it as though it's just two surfaces. And would van der Waals interactions between two surfaces be strong enough over? Yeah, well, that's in the Gulyan mechanism. That's essentially that idea.
Well, I don't need fluctuations for the way you said it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. The other question that you would like to ask is, after hearing Cyrus's talk, why don't we see such rafts in the DNA bilayer system? In that case, what we see is something that is more a bulk type, or at least a three-dimensional, real three-dimensional type structure. And so what I've been trying to give you an idea in the cartoon here is for the different scales in the system. The DNA diameter is essentially of order the diameter of the membrane. For the membrane to wrap around this DNA, when we're not talking about the hexagonal phase, it would be very costly as far as the bending energy is concerned. I haven't even mentioned bending energy when talking about this particle because, again, when we're talking about a diameter of 1 micron and a membrane whose thickness is of order 40 angstroms, that bending curvature is practically zero and we don't have to worry about it. So I think the only difference or the only special thing for this mechanism is the scales of the different components in the system. We're talking about very large vesicles, very thin membranes, and very large, relative to the membrane thickness, particles. And I'll stop here and answer any questions that remain. Yeah.
Wait. You have to ask questions.
Sorry.
Yeah. Same question again, maybe I didn't make it clear. You're emphasizing that there's a problem accounting for attractions between the particles to get these condensates. I was thinking more what limits the condensation and therefore defines the size.
Well, but I thought that the fact that maybe I went through it too quickly. The fact that you have the limiting I'm using all the excess area. In all cases, I'm using all the area available for adhesion. But the area available for adhesion doesn't tell me how much of the overall area would be covered.
Yeah.
No, it depends on the content of the liquid. You need the charged liquid to dissolve.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, thanks, Abhinav. Yeah, I think you're definitely in the right direction.
Okay.
Well, that's true, but that's true for both cases. That's, again, it's so nice to know that we're not, because we've gone through all these iterations back and forth. In all cases, at least in our simple idea, we're using all the area available for adhesion, all this A0. So that's true both for the floppy vesicles and for the tense vesicles. So that gives me one limitation. But that doesn't tell me how this area is distributed between different particles, because it could be that the particles would be completely engulfed or that there will be partially engulfed. Now, qualitatively, I would expect them to be as little as engulfed as possible, because then you take up the smallest amount of excess area, which entropy and everything else would drive us to. And so we'd expect to have just a large number of balls, but with a very small area of adhesion per ball. Because as long as the number of balls times their area of adhesion is constant, we don't care, as far as this idea of adhesion is concerned, how many balls are adsorbed. The thing that breaks the symmetry or the degeneracy in this case is the line tension, because the line tension does care whether you have this configuration or this configuration. In this configuration, the line tension is happy because essentially you have completely engulfed particles, and so even though this is a different composition than this one, the area between them or the line between them is very small. It won't be happy here. And so the line tension does give us a preference to having engulfed particles. Engulfed particles take up the largest amount of excess area possible. And so then you stop where you run into the constraint of the excess area. And that's why you get tense vesicles with only a small number of particles absorbed on them, although that small number of particles has still used all the A0 area available for adhesion.
But
so,
if I may just continue, I think this must be fair about these two. No, I mean, electrostatically, you said you need matching charge densities of vessels, counter ion release, which is complete here and incomplete here.
Right, but you forget that this one means that there's another particle that's completely floating up in solution and doesn't have any bilayer around it. So that's You always work in an imperfect world of Enon. Yeah.
The chain structure of a nanostructure, also 2D hexagonal structure, have been seen in the computer simulation about dipole probes. Okay, so I guess is you have the charge particle surrounding by the opposite charge of the second, so that's an internal dipole. Then you have dipole interaction, so they form a nanostructure. If you add a surface tension, then you form the 2D hexagonal.
Yeah, we haven't really thought about the later stages where you get the hexagonal crystallite structures. It seemed to us, at least initially, to be something that's more clearly understood. Once you know that you have this two-dimensional raft-like freely associating aggregate, that over time, probably the membrane goes on wrapping around these particles, bringing them together, and then they pack in hexagonal pattern. But we haven't really thought about that part so much. We were really interested in why a finite number of particles and why only on tense vesicles. Sergey?
Maybe I missed something. Did you say that you see these wolf attractions were millimolar range?
Where what?
Around millimolar CMC?
I don't remember.
Okay.
It was 0.2 millimolar maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
Compared, for example, to normal neutrophil, which is the nanomolar, picomolar.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, vesicles from such surfactants are very leaky. They just leak water like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What bothered me a lot, how can you get tense vesicles when it's so leaky?
Search me. How? What is the time scale for leaking? I mean, all I can say is this is what we observe, and that's we haven't even thought about it, because again, you know, the simple idea is you have a tense vesicle, it means that it's not water can't go through it, at least on the time scale of the observation, which is of order hours. We don't know over the week or 2 week scale when the vesicle essentially disappears and you get the final formed crystallites, what happens then, and you might be right that these become deflated, but by that time you already got the raft structure and it's more or less stable, and maybe more particles don't adhere so much. Yeah. The salt conditions, to get these adhesion phenomena, the salt has to be relatively low. Not zero, but definitely not one molar. When you go up to the one molar, you just don't get any adhesion. You get particles and you get vesicles. Now, I know it's a big window, but again, it's because she hasn't really explored the whole range. She just tried to see, as a control experiment, what happens if you dump a lot of salt in? Nothing happens. So you have to work in the low salt regime, but we haven't.
Can you measure directly how much those things go up and down?
In the crystallite, well, it's hard, and I don't know. Maybe other people could answer you better. In the crystallites, it seems like when you scan, you can use fluorescent surfactant, and it seems like you have fluorescence on the top and fluorescence on the bottom, which means that they're more or less completely covered. In the rafts, for technical reasons, they haven't been able to do that. And I don't know enough about the experiments to say, is that going to be solved next week or next month, or if that's an inherent problem? So.
Just a simple question. What's the order of magnitude in your estimates of the line energy per particle?
Well, that would depend on the coverage, which depends on the ratio.
But that's only a factor of 2 or 3.
It's
million KT.
No. The line tension is tiny. So we're thinking, I think the Lipovsky papers gives you, if you translate it to something like 0.1 KT per angstrom.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Okay. It's really small. It, it, It's really small, yeah, and we're not saying that it's anything but small, and that's why it doesn't really affect how much area you have available for adhesion and everything else if you want to minimize the energy consistently. But even though it's small, since everything else being equal, if you have only the adhesion,
what I'm asking is how small it is compared to the other thing which you've neglected, which is the curvature.
No, it's larger. Yeah, no, it's larger than the curvature energy. And again, Phil did a lot of work doing the curvature energy and taking all that into account. And unfortunately, after a month's worth of work, he found out that it's practically zero. So
the line tension compared to
the curvature energy here and the detachment and you know, all the nice details that could go into it.
What about the
What about the electrostatic repulsion between the two particles? They're not completely inside the membrane. They're not completely neutralized, so you presume that there should be.
We presume that there should be. There's nothing in the structure factor that indicates long-range repulsion. And so what we think is that probably because usually you will get the particles that are more or less engulfed, that the repulsion here between them would be relatively minimal. Again, explaining repulsion is something that's very easy in these systems. Explaining attraction over these length scales is somewhat more complicated.
This is what I want to say.
Yeah.
You have to have something to overcome the repulsion.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. The repulsion could be quite strong in just simple entropy of these particles. If they could diffuse instead of in this limited area over the whole vesicle surface, of course they'd like to do that. So there is a relatively strong attractive interaction, and right now I'm not sure if the mechanisms that were mentioned here, the van der Waals or the membrane, are really enough to overcome these behaviors.
Two quick things. You show these things about a diameter apart. They're not really stuck together. Second thing is all the little rafts, they're about the size of Antarctica. You'd never see rafts that are the size of Asia.
Again, that's just a coincidence of the pictures I have, because it's so much easier to see a raft that is much smaller than the vesicle area. You do see larger rafts, although I don't think that you can see rafts that are larger than about half the vesicle surface. But again, this is one of the problems when you work with pictures, is that you never know if another picture is going to come tomorrow and throw off all your ideas.
Combining what Bill asked and Tom and what I'm asking.
Yeah.
You have a given amount of particles absorbing on the surface. Basically, you have two-dimensional patterns. If you want to form one huge aggregate, maybe kinetic